Somewhere in the middle, I think I lied a little.
All right. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show, as always. You can join us at 844-967-2789. 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. You know, Sandy, while we await our guests, I wanted to talk with you about what's going on in Ukraine and the escalation of, you know, the rhetoric and other things. Here's an article. Ukraine can win the war, but the cost may be too high for the West. That's really the truth of it, right?
I mean, the cost to the West is like threefold. One of them is just all of the money that needs to flow to Ukraine in order to give them the wherewithal to achieve success in the battlefield, number one. Number two is the duration of the war. How long would the war have to go on in order for Ukraine to experience success? And how long can the West, in particular Europe, experience the downside of these sanctions with respect to, for instance, the very high cost of energy? And how long can the West's the unity of the West in terms of the alliance stay intact when America is able to essentially prosper? We aren't in recession. Our inflation is not at the same level as it is in Europe. It's off. You know, Europe is over 10%. We're on a decreasing slide in inflation, heading towards 5%. Our cost of energy is going down. The cost of energy in Europe is remaining very high. How long can the unity of the alliance stay in place in the face of that kind of dichotomy between what Europe is experiencing and what we're experiencing in the war? So, you know, it's going to be hard for the West to provide to Ukraine the time it would need and the money it would need in order to achieve battlefield success. So I'm confident that there's a growing amount of pressure for Ukraine to negotiate. Furthermore, there must be some pressure within Ukraine, because a success for Ukraine will involve a great deal of damage to Ukraine, its infrastructure, and its general capacity to manufacture and operate post-war. Is every month this war goes on is being damaged substantially.
Western military officials offer sobering assessment of what would be needed. So, again, it's David taking on Goliath, and all of the feel-good messages, I guess, that we see. Ukraine was just able to, hit parts of Russia again. These are pinpricks, basically, to Russia. When Ukraine can successfully, you know, blow something up, that's really a pinprick compared to what happens after the pinprick, right?
Yes. And you know, one thing that is important and clear is that these the ability of Ukraine to hit targets in Russia has been clearly established that those are Ukrainian built equipment that's doing that, which is important in terms of the U.S. view, because the U.S. does not want to experience a situation in which the U.S. equipment is viewed as enabling attacks on Russian homeland. The war is getting increasingly intricate. The ability of Ukraine to continue to experience success in the battlefield seems to require an increasing level of sophisticated weaponry from the West, of the sort that we were reluctant to provide early in the conflict and are now providing more of. So I think that article is dead on. I think that it will be dangerous to the West the longer this war continues. Not so much because Russia is likely to attack the West, but more likely because the unity of the West's alliance could fragment, which would be a problem. And similarly, the flow of money is so substantial.
You know, Sandy, it They're able to now, and early on in this, Ukraine was not hitting the homeland of Russia. They've now proven that they can. And so once they do that, it the ire is getting worse because they're able to hit a pinprick in Russia, and then Russia is looking to level.
Well, I think Ukraine's view is, hey, you're leveling us now. How much worse can this get? So I think that's why they're now reaching into Russia and trying to put some punishment there. I think the real concern the West has is that the more success Ukraine gets, let's say they take Mariupol over, and now they start aiming their guns and their attacks in Crimea, in the Crimea and towards Sevastopol, I think at that point, Russia will be very active and more active than they are now, because that area actually is viewed by Russia. That warm water port, Sevastopol, is very important to Russia strategically. And I don't think America has the appetite to actually do what it would take to take it away from them. So I think that they would like this matter to get settled before the crime is put into contest.
All right. I want to welcome my guest, none other than Mr. Michael Letts. Good morning to you, sir. How are you?
Good morning, Earl. How are you?
All right. It's good to hear from you again. Let's talk a little bit about who Michael Letts is.
Well, I'll tell you, we have done a national charity for 30 years to take care of our law enforcement officers and to help provide them with the necessary protection that they need, i.e. active shooter vests. And Earl, one thing you and I can't agree on is there's a lot of different ways to approach things, but making sure we have safe communities is of paramount importance to all of us.
All right. So my co-host is joining me today, Mr. Sandy Williams. So he's going to ask you some questions as well. You are now outspoken about the vaccine mandates, and it is your belief that this is not something that should be mandated to first responders and law enforcement, in that the government has no right in demanding that these vaccines be taken by first responders. Why?
Well, let's take a look at the facts, Earl. We now see it coming out, and this is all along. You remember, first of all, they didn't want to release the ingredients for 75 years. They were trying to hide things from the American people. Now we're beginning to see that the facts that are coming out on the vaccine, it has potentially very adverse effects on an awful lot of people who've taken it. There is no reason why law enforcement and first responders should be guinea pigs for the rest of society. That thing did not go through nearly enough testing. And that to put their lives at risk is more than reprehensible, quite frankly, Earl.
So even if at the time that this came into play, everybody knew the devastation that it was wreaking on the American people. More people died in this country from COVID than all the rest of the nations combined. And you didn't think that it was important enough that our nation do everything within its power to try to do something to curb what we knew was a pandemic?
Sure. It's important enough that we put our resources together and try to find a solution.
Isn't that what the government did when it came up with the vaccinations?
Well, they carried it one step further. They stepped on individual rights. They came up with solutions. They should have allowed the people to decide if that was the best solution for them. They didn't. They exercised their utilitarian authority to stand on individual human rights and liberties. That's where we have a problem.
Well, let me just ask a question. I mean, and nationally speaking, there was never such a mandate. There were mandates created in certain circumstances. If people wanted to do X, they had to do Y. So if you wanted to get on an airplane and fly, then you needed to demonstrate that you were vaccinated. You know, if you wanted to do this or that, if you wanted to stay home and then you didn't need to be vaccinated. Now, I presume you're talking about vaccination mandates that occur in the workplace, maybe in hospital settings or in police force settings
or first responder
settings. Now, my view of the ability to do mandates, I mean, we all experienced a mandate when we were growing up, if we were old enough, to have smallpox vaccinations. And smallpox vaccinations had a modest potential for side effects, but it was quite modest. When the Salk vaccine came out for polio, we all went in and had polio injections almost immediately. And so the issue, I think, with mandates is that the public has to demonstrate that there is a public problem or a public need that is being met by the requirement that there be vaccination. So that, for instance, to the extent that the public would mandate a vaccination to the public, it would be because the public hospital system could collapse if there weren't vaccinations, and if vaccinations were going to limit the number of people who got so sick that they needed to go to the hospital. And I think in large part the encouragement that was put out by the National Health Service to get vaccinated was designed to protect, not to protect people from getting COVID, but to protect them from getting so sick that they had to go to the hospital. My view of the vaccination requirement in the workplace is that workplaces that are short of workers have a concern about having too many sick days in which their workers would be lost to the disease in such a way that they would not be available to carry out their public function and their work. So I think that was, in large part at least, the basis, the rationale for the vaccination requirements in hospitals. I'm not sure, but I suspect that was the rationale as well in places where it was being required of first responders. Do you disagree with that rationale?
The rationale sounds fine. It didn't work out that way. Look at how many people that were fired and lost on the job, how many additional people died after the vaccination. Fact of the matter is the government lied to us. They knew they were lying to us, and they knew it all along. Now the documentation from Twitter and others began to prove that from where it was originated, et cetera. That's the problem, is I wholeheartedly support our government doing everything they can to protect our people.
So
when they cross the line and make it a mandate, that's wrong.
Mike, hold on. We've got to go to a break. 844-967-2789 is the number. On the line, Mr. Michael Letts. He's the president and CEO. To the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Monday. That means Mondays with Sandy Williams. We're joined today by a good friend, host Mr. Michael Letts. He's a founder, president, and CEO of Invest USA, and that's a grassroots effort to provide bulletproof vests for law enforcement. And so today we're having a dialogue about the fact that mandates that might you believe the government mandated that law enforcement and first responders take these vaccinations as a Mike, have you been vaccinated?
I have not.
Did you have any family members who, you know, contracted COVID or perished or any of those things? You don't believe that?
I had family members that did contract COVID on multiple occasions. But, you know, when you take a look, Earl, and here's some of the other medical statistics, you know, we know for a fact that oftentimes patients that died who had COVID did not necessarily die from COVID. There's a big difference. And there was an attempt and a move by the government to control its citizens by mandating a vaccination and inflating and misrepresenting figures. And that's where I have a problem, Earl. I do not have a problem at all with the government. Should have a responsibility to its citizens to do all it can to protect. But it crosses the line when it removes their freedoms and liberties and gives information that is not accurate that is not complete and mandates that people act on that without having a free will. That's where we come into a problem, Earl.
Well, mandates have been relatively limited. You know, as I said, the general public of the United States was never mandated to have vaccinations. Vaccinations were voluntary for, I'm sure, 98% of the people who got vaccinated in this country. With respect to the information that was provided, I think that many people assumed when they were getting vaccinated that the vaccine would keep them from getting COVID altogether, but I don't think that was ever
I don't think that was stated.
I think that Fauci and others who presented it always talked about.
Look at your current president. He stated that.
Well, I think that if you went out and polled the public, I would think that most people in the public understood that the vaccine would keep them potentially from contracting COVID in a manner that would make it a severe disease for them. But we've all had experience with the flu vaccine, for instance, and the promise was never made with the flu vaccine that you wouldn't get the flu. You were always told that if you got the flu vaccine, it would keep you hopefully from getting a serious case of the flu that might put you in the hospital. So,
But, you know, Sam, it was never taken to this point either. The difference between the flu and COVID, we never with the flu vaccine said that first responders would be terminated if they did not. Our health workers would be terminated if they didn't have the flu vaccine. We never took a position that said, oh, because of the flu, you have to wear a mask, which we all know. Talking about first responders and EMS workers and all, we've got enough medical training to realize that was a farce.
The data, the longitudinal data, there have been broad and large studies now made. And the fact is that the use of masks has been proven to be efficacious. It did work to reduce the level of transmissibility. You know, it's not foolproof.
We have documentation that says the exact opposite. So which one are we going to believe?
I'll look at the broadest longitudinal studies and conclude that that they're probably most likely correct.
Studies that show the masks don't work.
Pardon me?
Some of these are worldwide studies that show the mask never had any.
So, Mike, let me ask you. If you don't wear the mask, we clearly know you're going to have even a greater probability that you're going to contract something, right?
No, I think
that is a decision that you, or I'm using an example, you make that decision. You know what your occupation is. You decide what the risk factor is you are willing to live with or not willing to live with.
Here's where I come down on that particular issue, and that's why I come back to the community interest and the public interest. If you are for instance, a hospital, and you have barely enough healthcare workers in your hospital working, and if 20% of them are out on sick leave at the same time, your hospital essentially collapses because of its inability to provide care.
Or law enforcement.
Or law enforcement has the same potential. So
sure.
I think the notion was made that we can't, from the standpoint of public interest, leave this to personal decision-making in the circumstance in which that personal decision-making has a higher probability of jeopardizing the broad public interest. So that's my only point. I agree that mandates should not be handed out willy-nilly. We shouldn't mandate something to somebody to save them from themselves.
Sure.
But I do think that we have to consider mandates in the circumstance in which the broad public interest is affected, so that I don't think anyone argued with the need for smallpox vaccinations, because as a human race, we were actually jeopardized in existence by that kind of a disease. It had the potential to be a plague. So
I think you have a good point, Sam, but let's play it out. Give me any documentation that I ever had a law enforcement agency or a hospital that could not function because of the fact that there was an overabundance of COVID-19 in that particular area, and these mandates or these precautions somehow helped alleviate that situation.
I think there is plenty of evidence that sick days of workers in hospitals has left hospitals entirely strapped for workers. They're starting out short and ending up with such a shortage that healthcare workers have been under extreme stress because of And one of the reasons being because of the number of sick days that have been had to be taken by healthcare workers, and that it's clear that if they were not taking,
year,
if they were not taking the precaution, no, this isn't the case every year, and if the precautions that they were taking hadn't been taken, it's likely that that healthcare problem would have been exacerbated. So,
guys, hang on. We've got to go to a break. 844-967-2789. My good friend Michael Letch is on the line. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Mondays. That's Mondays with Sandy Williams. My guest is the founder, president, and CEO of InvestUSA, Mr. Michael Letch. It's a grassroots organization. And they provide vests, bulletproof vests for law enforcement across the nation. Mike, you still there?
I'm still here, sure.
Okay, so while we were, in the break, Sandy and I were, I asked Sandy the question, people's rights and freedoms, when you work for somebody, they're kind of limited to what the owner of the company you're working for. He's got his regulations and whatnot, and they outweigh what your rights are. I mean, you have an option to quit, but you certainly don't have a right to tell him what you're going to do and what you're not going to do. Would you agree with that?
I would agree, Earl, but now where you're headed with this conversation, and I get a kick out of it. That's why I love being on your show, Earl. So we're going to trade community's right to be safe and to be protected, because if law enforcement decides I shouldn't be subject myself to a vaccine that's unproven that perhaps can cause me irreparable damage, then we're going to, I have the right to resign, to quit. But now who's going to complain for the community when they have no protection?
I just, in terms of getting back to mandates generally, the question of the safety of the vaccines is up in the air, right? I mean, I think the general medical...
Well, I'm not sure that I agree with you that it's up in the air.
Well, I think the medical community, broadly speaking, would argue with you rather vociferously that it's actually proven to be based on the millions and millions and millions of people who were vaccinated and the nature of the side effects. But there definitely are side effects, and I think that is clear, and I think the nature of the side effects over time has become more and better understood. Tell me this. Are police officers required? When you work in a factory, you have to wear safety glasses and you have to wear safety shoes if you're in certain kinds of places. And you don't have a choice. You don't have a choice about that. Those shoes aren't comfortable. The glasses are a pain in the butt.
Hearing protection.
But if you don't wear them, you can't work there. So that's a mandate that goes against just general free will. In the police departments, I would guess that many police departments mandate the wearing of those bulletproof vests, don't they?
Put it this way, we won't give you one without it being mandated.
Okay, so that bulletproof vest is mandated. It's uncomfortable. It could cause even heat stroke in the summers because of the added heat that you get from it. But they wear them, and they wear them because the police department doesn't want these people to be injured on the job. Probably 90% of that is compassion and worry about the injury to the policeman, but at least 10% is worry about loss of policemen, right? And the numbers of policemen and the availability of these people for law enforcement. So that mandate isn't a lot different than the mandate for getting vaccinated, except that you have a concern about the safety, the personal safety of the vaccine itself. So I guess I'm just one.
Yeah, but the one difference, Sam, is that when you give me a vaccine, I can't undo it. I give you a vest. If for some reason we're having an issue, you can take the vest off. I can pull you off of duty. You can take the vest off. I can't unvaccinate you. Once you're vaccinated, the effects on your body are for a life.
Yes.
And that's an ominous statement to make.
Well, the issue is whether that's an unreasonable risk to ask someone to take, because you know, probably any shot that you get has the potential for a side effect. Any medication that you take has the potential, in fact, almost the certainty that there could be a side effect. So our world is...
Sure, it almost always is.
Yeah, the world is filled with side effects, potentially, and the question is whether you're being asked to take an unreasonable risk of an unreasonable side effect. And I guess that's where you believe that the science is such that the risks associated with this vaccine is an unreasonable risk. And I don't think we can debate that, because I'm not a scientist and neither are you. So we're each relying on kind of hearsay evidence that we've seen.
And quite frankly, Sam, I'm having a blast, Earl, being on your show. Well, but you know, the one thing that we need to keep in mind is I should have the ability to analyze both sides and determine what is best for my health, for my body. And you're right, Earl. If I don't like it, I can always resign. It's a mandate. But I'm doing a great disservice to the American people by forcing first responders to resign and leave them vulnerable to crime, to lack of EMS workers, to lack of firefighters, because government took an obtrusive position that they can't substantiate today.
So when you say they can't substantiate it, as a person who's been vaccinated,
how many people, Earl, didn't die because of the vaccine? Do we know?
Plenty
of people still died after being vaccinated. Plenty of people still died after being vaccinated. Plenty of people still got it after being vaccinated.
Yes.
So
yes.
Did it help? I'm not going to argue about whether it did or did not help. Was it worth the ROI, the return on investment? Was it worth the risk factor? That should be an individual decision.
Sandy and I both contracted COVID, and we're both vaccinated.
Well, I think you're making the point about making personal decisions related to the downside risk of health risks and human risks,
right,
associated with a vaccine or a medicine. And I'm simply saying that there are broad public interests that have in situations where people have been required to take that personal risk because of the public interest in avoiding, for instance, epidemic, okay? And, if Ebola hit the continent here and Ebola became a real risk of a real epidemic, and if there was a vaccine that had an 80% success rate against Ebola and a 5% possibility of killing you, I suspect we would still be mandated to take that vaccine, because when you look at the ROI, to use your term, from the public's perspective, we should all take that risk. We should all play that Russian roulette, because it's going to save the community,
right,
and save the race. No, in that circumstance, you wouldn't have the right, because everyone would say, I might be one of those 10% or 5% that's going to have this serious downside. So I'm willing to risk my death.
But if I have the vaccination, why do I care? Because I protected myself.
Well, I'm just saying that
if I'm vaccinated, why do I care? Because I have protected myself. So that's your issue.
No,
if you want to take that risk and be one part of the 10%, so be it.
No, I'm just saying that this public interest thing is what overrides personal judgment, but it all comes down to whether there is a sufficient public interest to support the mandate.
And that's a very slippery slope.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But this debate is not new. Polio.
No, are right, Earl. It is not new.
Tuberculosis, mumps, measles. As children, when it used to be, Sandy, I don't know if it's that way anymore, these shots children had to take at birth. Was that mandated? And some of that was mandated. Is that correct, Sandy?
Some shots have been mandated. Some were mandated in order to matriculate in schools.
Yes.
To avoid the potential contagion in the school setting, which is the public interest being reflected. Look, I'm not sure I can carry the debate any further than this, because I simply believe that the public interest can overwhelm the choice process for an individual in certain circumstances, and the question is whether those circumstances exist or don't exist with respect to the COVID vaccine. Certainly, the understanding of COVID as a disease has changed. We currently are overwhelmed by a multiplicity of. We have this RVS virus. We have influenza A and COVID, which has our hospitals right now overwhelmed. So, you know, our hospitals now are in a very perilous circumstance. And if you get something else that requires critical care in a hospital, you probably won't get the same attention. There were probably a bunch of deaths that occurred during the COVID epidemic because of the fact that the hospitals couldn't undertake anything that seemed at all discretionary. And many discretionary kinds of medical procedures weren't carried out, which resulted in the death of the person who didn't get the procedure. So
I agree with, you know, but that's a whole other, and I'm glad you brought that up, Sandy, because we are talking about real solutions. That's what I love about our old show. Let's talk about what you just said and how it also affects law enforcement. So why don't we address the issue of making sure there are enough first responders on the street to deal with the violent crime increase? Why don't we make sure there are enough healthcare workers that if those that are out sick, it doesn't affect the quality of care? Why don't we address real problems that affect real people instead of trying to press an issue that gets down a slippery slope, mandating whether somebody has to comply with an edict from a government that may or may not be being honest with the people that it represents?
Well, I think the mandates for first responders aren't federal mandates, are they? I think they're mandates that are coming locally, even from hospital systems or from local police districts. So I wouldn't want to lump in the federal government, which is the disseminator of the information, and the local governments, which are making these decisions, or the local businesses, which are making the decisions. But I certainly agree with you that the American system ought to be focusing on real problems, and a lot of those real problems relate to funding, adequate attention being paid to the public's interest, and enough police, enough social workers to deal with what otherwise could turn into police problems, enough mental care workers to deal with the people who might otherwise resort to criminal conduct. You know, you're right. There's all kinds of more basic issues, but I don't think that this mandate issue that we're now talking about rises to the level of a national political issue. It relates more to local politics and local business situations.
I would differ with you, but that's okay.
So let me ask the both of you, because when this debate came into existence, don't we have to take a look at where the world was and the nation was at that time? And certainly it's
I think the caller, I don't think you're talking about what was, although sometimes our conversation sounds like you want to talk about what was under the Trump administration.
No, I'm talking about from the time watching what was taking place and all the people dying, mm-hmm, and the hospitals overflowing. And what was our government to do? Just sit back, Sandy, and not respond? It had to respond.
Well, I'm just saying the government's response was very few mandates. The only mandates,
right,
the only mandates I'm aware of related to travelers, okay? And otherwise, the federal mandates were few and far between.
Wearing masks in schools. That wasn't federal.
That
right.
wasn't federal.
Local.
Those were CDC
local.
Recommendations.
Right.
The CDC had recommendations that were put out, but they weren't mandates. And so there were very few government mandates. So that we've
a lot of those into funding standards.
Well, we've sort of tried to morph the discussion from recommendations into mandates, and we've tried to morph it into an us versus them political thing. I think today's world, in today's circumstance, the mandates I'm aware of are all being generated locally and not federally. And in fact, the federal circumstances of travel, those mandates have been lifted altogether. So we aren't really in a circumstance now of more material spreading of mandates, and I'm not sure that the information coming out of the federal government now is even very. I don't think there's much information coming out of the federal government right now relating to the vaccine and its safety. I think a lot of that is coming out of the manufacturers and the studies that are being done by the manufacturing of the serum.
So, Sandy, let me and hold on, Mike, and I'll let you respond. So sure. What I don't understand is, depending on where you live, maybe the state that you live in, you happen to live in a state that doesn't believe in vaccinations and those kinds of things. If your government has information that supersedes the information that the states have, because you live in a state where you live, you should be at risk, Sandy, because the states, the local have, you know, the control over what happens.
Well,
even if the federal government has better information?
I think the federal government, in spite of all the rhetoric surrounding it, I think the federal government has always been reluctant to impose mandates, and they've had suggestions. I think sometimes the caller is right that funding for certain things has accompanied some force behind the suggestions, but I just don't think the debate exists any longer.
April 4, 967-2789, Texas at the same number. It's Monday. That's Mondays with Sandy Williams. And as always, a great conversation with my good friend Michael Letts, who is the founder, president, and CEO of Invest USA, a grassroots effort to provide vests for law enforcement. Mike, before we went to break, there was something you wanted to say. I want to give you that opportunity.
Well, I was just simply saying that, you know, it's always very helpful. One of the things I've admired about Earl and his show is it's good to be able to debate and to be able to present evidence on both sides in a very friendly and a frankful manner that's non-confrontational. Just because you don't believe what I say, I don't believe what you say, doesn't mean you're right or I'm right or either one. But it allows the public to take that opportunity and use the information that they have. And so it's an honor to be on your show, Earl.
Well, it's always an honor to have you and Sandy as well. But go ahead.
You know, on this particular issue, I think the health risk and what we're seeing more and more come out, I've had more and more first responders who were capitulated to the pressure and took it, who now deeply regret it. And I hate to see that because they gave their lives to provide protection and to support the general public. And they've been forced into a decision that compromised their health was just morally wrong. And I'll always take that position.
You know, I would just respond to that in this manner. Individually, there are probably some people who fall in that category. But there's also many other law enforcement officers that I know and first responders who gladly took the vaccinations and didn't feel as if they were forced into doing it. They did it because they were concerned about the health risk of themselves and their families. And so there is no unilateral response by first respondents that we all agree that this was an inherent danger to ourselves. There were probably as many, if not more, of them who willfully took the vaccinations. And I guess the question will be to you is, you know, in the end, you know, I'm a guy who took the vaccination. Sandy, you talked about the side effects. I just took the latest vaccination and my thing was, listen, I'm more concerned about the virus than I am about the vaccination.
Well, you know, I think the caller's position is one that it's their personal choice, and there's no question that generally, broadly speaking, in healthcare, everyone's personal choice should be paramount, and the only issue is whether there's a public interest that overrides that personal choice based on the danger to the public posed by that freedom of choice. If you're free not to do it, and if not doing it poses a substantial risk to the public. And I think the caller and I agree about that. We just disagree about the facts in this circumstance and whether it justifies it. So it's been good sure. to talk to you. Good. And I think it's
always a privilege, Sandy, and I appreciate and I respect your opinion. and I'm sure you respect mine, and, you know, and I respect the our first responders, and I respect what Earl just said. There are those who felt very good about taking, and there are those who didn't, but those who didn't should never have been mandated and forced to have done so or lose their job and their livelihood.
So, Mike, before we let you go, let's talk about why providing the kind of vests that you guys provide. Is it law enforcement automatically provides vests for every person who becomes a law enforcement officer? Is that correct?
No, let's give the statistics. When we started this organization 30 years ago, 52% of officers had no protection at all. The only protection available was what we call a concealable vest.
30 years ago.
30 years ago.
Okay, but what 30 about years today?
We got that number down to 20%, or less than 20%, who still did not have vests, but we were working our way down. Then the criminal element changed how they conducted things and began to use long-range rifles, which a concealable vest will not stop. So we had to create new technology called active shooter vests, which will stop a long-range rifle. Unfortunately, as we speak today, almost 90% of officers across the country do not have this new technology. And so they're at great risk because the criminal element is using long-range rifles and assault rifles to target law enforcement to eliminate them.
You raised that, and this is really probably unfair of me, but how do you feel about gun control and gun rights? What you just described is in large part a unique to America circumstance because of the fact that we've got 20 million long-range rifle AR-15 types of weaponry in the hands of civilians. Just curious because it's such a controversial issue. I don't know where you sit on the political spectrum, but it strikes me that law enforcement he has mixed feelings about this.
Well, there are some in law enforcement that have mixed feelings, but the vast majority of us agree that we actually support citizens being able to be armed because of the fact that lawful citizens use it for the right purposes, and the criminal element have no intention of giving up their arms anyway,
regardless
of the legislation you pass.
What is the lawful purpose that 20 million AR-15s could be put to? I mean, you can't use them to hunt, so you could only use them to shoot at targets. Is it that big a sport that 20 million people are taking their AR-15s to shooting ranges?
Well, it gets back to the same issue that we talked about with the vaccinations. Who has the right to choose for us, Sandy? I mean, if I'm dependent on the government to start telling me and make my decisions for me, I'm screwed.
Yeah, but you know...
Well, there is a public interest as well. Well, we don't need. This is a whole different issue, whole different subject. But
being back on our show, and we'll discuss this one too.
Well, it's always good, Mike, having you on. I respect you tremendously, and as I said to you the last time, as long as I have an opportunity to be on the air, we're going to have conversations with Michael Letts.
Well, thank you, Earl. I feel the same way, and I think we're making progress. I just want the American citizen to know what the facts are and to make the determination what's best for him and for his family.
All right, Mike. Thank you very much. Sandy, as always, another great conversation. We've got to get out of here. I'll be back on tomorrow. You've tuned into the Earl Ingram Show. Thank you, Connor. See you all later.